Joseph was the 11th born son of Jacob, but he was the oldest son of his favorite wife, Rachel. And so Israel, verse 3 of Genesis 37, loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Jacob showed everybody that he favored Joseph. He had been himself a victim of parental favoritism, but he in turn did that with his children. We really ought to learn from those kinds of situations. But often parental bad attitudes reemerge in their children. And certainly you can see that in this. There were a couple other factors in the brothers hating Joseph's guts. He had tattled on some of his brothers who evidently were not caring for the flocks properly in verse 2. And he told his brothers and his father about his dreams. And his dreams involved the idea, apparently, that his siblings and parents would bow down before him one day. And that just further increased their jealousy and anger and frustration at this braggadocious brother of theirs, the way they would have looked at that. So, at 17 years old, Joseph was sent to check on his brothers who were taking care of the flock, shepherding the flocks. He goes a long, long ways, and they see him coming at a distance. He's in uniform. He's got that coat on. And they say to one another in 19, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let's see what will become of his dreams." So they already are plotting their cover story for doing him in and sort of egg each other on into a frenzy. They're going to kill him. Then we'll see about those dreams. But they end up selling him instead. After all, you might as well make some money off of him. They put him in a pit first, and then in verse 25, they sat down to eat a meal. Mistreating their brother doesn't seem to hurt their appetite one little bit. But when they see the traders coming, they sell him. And verse 31, they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. It's kind of ironic. The same man who had deceived his father with goat skin and his brother's clothes was deceived by his sons with goat's blood and his sons and their brother's clothes. And so they just sort of take it to Jacob and they say, "Well, kind of looks like not our brothers, but your sons. What do you think?" And he draws the conclusion and he just continues to grieve. You don't really know at this point what that continuing grief is doing to those brothers. Are they more and more infuriated that he would grieve that the death of his no-count son that long? Or are they more and more guilty and they can't really tell him that he's not really dead because that would incriminate themselves? But at any rate, Jacob refuses to be comforted, and month after month, year after year, he grieves the death of his beloved son. Meanwhile, Joseph is sold to the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard in Egypt. And he is ultimately, with the Lord being with him and blessing him, he's put in charge of this Potiphar's household. He was really blessed. But he sort of suffered from one endowment too many. He was good looking. And Mrs. Potiphar fell in love with him and continued to insist that he be with her. Now, that would have been a strong temptation. I mean, it would have been a temptation, I think, for Joseph to have felt sorry for himself. I mean, you think about how mistreated he has been. He really didn't himself do anything wrong. Look at what his brothers did to him. I mean, sold as a slave at 17, down to another country, is no piece of cake. When you feel sorry for yourself, you are the most vulnerable to temptation. Because it's so easy to justify. After all, look at all that's happened to me. You know, I'm entitled to a little bit of, you know, enjoyment in my life or whatever. He could have let his success go to his head. He had risen to a pretty high position. He's a slave, but he's a slave in charge of all the other ones in his household. And she is persistent. She was forever reopening the closed question. Sometimes we can resist for a while, but Satan just keeps hammering away, and eventually our defenses let loose. It would be flattering to think that Miss Potiphar thinks you're good looking and wants to have a relationship with you. And finally, you remember what she did. She's grabbed him. You could have easily said, well, I mean, I don't want this, you know, but I have no choice. I mean, you know, here it is. But he leaves the coat in her hand and flees. Now you can see some real keys in Joseph overcoming that temptation. I like what he said in verse 8, 39:8. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? We looked last night at how when Jacob tried to resist temptation, he just says it won't work. But with Joseph, he says, this is a great evil and a sin against God, and I will not do it. If we are ever going to overcome temptation, we have to say absolutely no on the basis of principles that will not bend. It is not a matter that, well, I'm not going to do it unless it gets too tempting, unless the circumstances are too rough, or whatever. It's a matter we will not do the wrong thing, period. It is a sin against God. That is the only way to deal with temptation. He refused even to lay down beside her. And he stayed firm. It's better to lose a good coat than good character. And so he flees. Well, how do you feel as a rejected woman in this situation? She's angry with Joseph. And she has his coat. And she screams. They come to her scream. She said, would you look at this? This Hebrew my husband brought in. Well, he was trying to force me. He left his coat beside me. See, there's the evidence. He's already disrobing. And I screamed, and he fled. Well, you know, all that's kind of right. She does have his coat. She did scream. Of course, the coat wasn't exactly laid beside her. She actually had it in her hand. And she kind of reversed the order of events. You know, she screamed after he left, not while he was there. But, you know, it's kind of right. I have no idea what Mr. Potiphar really thought, but he put Joseph in prison as a result of that. I want to ask you a question. Can you imagine the rumors that flew in Egypt about Joseph? What about this? Is there always fire where there is smoke? Is it always true that if there's a rumor, there's got to be some kind of truth to it? Well, sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's not. Is there any blame in Joseph in this one whatsoever? Nothing. Amen. There's a whole lot of smoke, but there is no fire. Joseph did the right thing. The rumors are absolutely false. Do not judge things on the basis of hearing something until we know the facts. We do not know the true story. Proverbs says in Proverbs 18 and verse 17, the first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him. We got to know the facts before we judge. Well, poor Joseph. You do what's right, and here's what it gets you. I mean, you know, it wasn't his fault that his brothers sold him into slavery. And it sure isn't his fault that he got thrown in Egyptian prison. He was doing the right thing. You ever done that? You ever done exactly the right thing, and it blew up in your face and caused all sorts of terrible problems, and you're thinking, well, why did I even bother? I thought God was supposed to take care of you in these situations. Now, we know the whole Joseph story. So we know that actually this was a step in the process of blessing Joseph. But Joseph doesn't know that. It may be that the terrible tragedy we're suffering because we did the right thing is a step in the process of blessing us. But we don't see the whole picture like God does. And it took a long time for the developments to show what God was up to in this story. Well, in prison, God's with him, and he rises to be in charge of the other prisoners. And one day, Pharaoh's baker and cupbearer are both in jail with him, and they're troubled. They both had a dream they can't explain. Joseph, to his credit, even though he's a prisoner and suffering himself, cares about them. He gives the credit to God and interprets their dreams. The baker was going to be hung in 3 days, but the butler, the cupbearer, in 3 days was going to be restored to his position. And Joseph asks him to remember him and to put in a good word for him before Pharaoh, because it's really unjust that he's even in prison in the first place. Now, can you imagine Joseph? Okay, the cupbearer got out. Wonder how many hours it's going to be. How many days is it going to be? How many months? And your hope just sort of dwindles away. And we know what Joseph, I guess, finally imagined. Cupbearer forgot him. There is so much injustice in this story. Sold by his brothers, twice advancing, and then being set aside by Miss Potiphar's lies and the cupbearer's forgetfulness and lack of appreciation for Joseph interpreting his dreams. You can't determine God's timetable. But Joseph is 30. When he gets out of prison, he was 17 when he was sold. I have a hard time waiting 13 minutes for God to resolve a matter. Can you imagine 13 years? You're going to still be faithful to God 13 years after everything just keeps going wrong, even though you're trying to do what you believe God would want you to do, and you don't have anybody around you to support your faith. Joseph's amazing. Well, it turns out that even the cupbearer's forgetfulness worked in Joseph's favor, because when Pharaoh has his dream and nobody can explain it, that's when the cupbearer says, oh yeah, there was this guy back in prison, and they bring him out and he interprets the dream. 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of scarcity. And Joseph's advice is, find somebody who can appoint in charge of warehousing huge amounts of this abundance to provide for the years of scarcity. And Pharaoh says, I believe that man's you. And so, from prison to vice Pharaoh in one day, pretty amazing advance. Joseph had been faithful over little things. Now he's going to be ruler over the land of Egypt. And what if Joseph had given in to Miss Potiphar? Do you see how this story might have turned out very differently? Well, this famine happens to be, they gather the food during the 7 years of plenty. Now the 7 years of famine are upon us, and it's kind of a generalized famine, not just Egypt. And Jacob realizes they're starving to death, and there's food he's heard about down in Egypt, so he tells the brothers, I want you to go down and buy grain. And he wants to get as much as he can, so he sends as many as possible to buy the food. He sends 10 sons to buy the food. He had 12. Of course, he's not going to send Joseph because he thinks he's dead and he's already in Egypt selling the food. But there's still one missing brother in that. Oh yeah, that was Benjamin. Benjamin was Joseph's full brother. He was the only other child through his favorite wife, Rachel. Rachel actually died in childbirth with Benjamin. The only one left of Rachel is Benjamin. So Jacob sends the 10, but he didn't send Benjamin. Verse 42:4, he said, I am afraid that harm may befall him. It looks to me like Benjamin is the new Joseph. Well, they haven't a clue they're talking to Joseph, never expecting to see him, and certainly not as vice pharaoh in charge of famine relief. And I imagine he was looking for them, I don't know. He knows a lot more about them than they know he knows, and he calls them aside and starts interrogating them. And, well, he says they're spies. I don't know too many spies who would travel in units of 10, but he says they're spies, and well, they get down to talking about their family roots and the reason for their visit and so forth. And they even speak of, they've got this one brother who's dead, and they don't realize they're actually speaking to the dead brother, those words. And Joseph puts him in prison for 3 days. They get a little dose of their own medicine, and he decides that he's going to hold one of them hostage, send the other 9 back for their other brother they say they have, and that'll prove their story that they're not really spies if they bring him back. Well, he found out by overhearing them, they speak in Hebrew, they have no idea, Vice Pharaoh knows Hebrew, that Reuben had tried to save him. So instead of holding hostage the firstborn Reuben, he holds the secondborn Simeon, which is kind of interesting. And the rest of them he sends back with the sacks of grain and, well, as it turned out, somehow mysteriously their money has come back into the sacks of grain. They get down to their father, and they find the money, and they're spooked. Their aroused consciences interpret every unexpected development as a sign of God's wrath. I mean, I think most of us, if the money was back in our sacks, we'd have said, this is our lucky day. This is awesome. But they're worried about even that. And they tell Jacob what had happened and how they're going to have to bring Benjamin if they ever go back, or if they're ever going to get Simeon back. And 36, their father Jacob said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, you may put my 2 sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you. I don't know why he thought Jacob's killing 2 of his grandkids was going to make up for losing Benjamin. I think he was trying to be helpful. Jacob said, now this is significant. Look at verse 38. Jacob said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Did you get that? My son won't go down with you guys. Suddenly, they're not sons. My son is Benjamin. You guys are expendable, but I can't lose him. Never mind Simeon languishing in jail. My son won't go down with you. Whoa. We don't know yet what these brothers think about this. But if they had an ounce of what they had earlier in the story, they would be livid at a statement like that. Can you imagine? You're 10 of the 11, and your dad says, "Oh, my son won't go with you guys. No, he can't hear. I don't dare risk his life." Wow. Well, they need to go back. Food's running out. Jacob said, "All right, why don't you go back?" You know, kind of like, "Yeah, go down to the store and get us something." And Judah said, "No, the man said we can't see his face unless we bring our little brother." And Jacob said, "Why didn't you even tell him we had a brother?" Of course, Jacob knows well dishonesty. But Judah said, "We didn't know what he was going to say. We just answered the question." Really, Jacob didn't have a lot of choice. I mean, okay, so he risked the boy, something happened to him on the journey, or they die of starvation, you know. I mean, hey, the risk is probably worth it. So reluctantly, he lets Benjamin go, and he said, "Oh, if I grieve, I grieve. You know, he's gone." He's really pretty pessimistic about the whole affair. Well, they get down there to Egypt, and Joseph had brought in immediately, and of course they start immediately explaining they brought more money, and they brought the money that was in their sacks. They don't have got their sacks, and they're really sorry and all this. And they're brought in for a big meal with Vice Pharaoh. Now, if you remember, most of those brothers were born in about 6 or 7 years. And there's 11 of them. They are seated in age order. This is really weird. And little Benjamin, well, he's not little, but youngest Benjamin gets 5 times as much food on his plate than the others do. That's weird. Well, chapter 44, then he commanded, Joseph commanded his house steward, saying, "Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack." Oh, now we understand that one. "Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain." And he did as Joseph had told him. You know, I wonder what that house steward thought when he says, "I want you to put that special silver cup of mine in the sack of the youngest one." I guess he really liked that boy, didn't he? He's giving him his silver cup. I don't know, it's kind of weird. A lot of strange things happening. But it gets stranger. Verse 3, as soon as it was light, the men were sent away, they with their donkeys. They had just gone out of the city and were not far off, when Joseph said to his house steward, "Up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed uses for divination? You have done wrong in doing this.'" So, he's to catch up to them and accuse them of stealing his cup. He overtook them and spoke these words to them. They said to him, "Why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money with which we found in the mouth of our sacks we have brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die." Ouch. "And we will also be my Lord's slaves." So he said, "Now let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and the rest of you shall be innocent." Then they hurried, each man lowering his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. He searched, beginning with the oldest. This is quite an award-winning performance on the part of this steward. He knows right where that cup is, because he put it there. But we start with the oldest boy's sack, and we open it. And we look through his sack, and we close it back off, and then we go to number 2. Can you imagine the mounting disgust and indignation on the part of these brothers as one by one, "We told you we didn't steal that cup." Until they opened Benjamin's sack and there's the cup. That stupid little brother! What in the world was he thinking? He wants to get all of his in trouble stealing that cup! Can you imagine how you would have felt if your little brother, he's not young, but he's youngest, had stolen the cup? It's right there in his sack. He's getting all of you in trouble. The dad already thinks he can do no wrong. And he's the one that's going to cost you all your freedom to live the rest of your life as slaves in Egypt or worse. So they go back, all of them. And verse 15, Joseph said to them, "What is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination? I mean, you know, that cup could track you anywhere." Of course, they had the cup, but never mind. So Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak, and how can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found." But Joseph said, "Far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave, but as for you, go in peace to your father." Now, are you beginning to see what's going on? Joseph has given them a golden opportunity to betray the new Joseph. They have a perfect excuse to ditch him. He stole the cup. Joseph has masterminded a strategy to find out if these brothers have changed or not. When they get an even better opportunity to palm off the new Joseph, are they gonna take advantage of it and scram? I mean, this is going to be their hands are clean on this one. They had some blood on their hands with Joseph. But they're innocent in this one. And they can get rid of him, and they're good. Will they? Do they hate him as much as they hated Joseph himself? See, I think Joseph wanted to reconcile with them all along, but he can't do that unless he knows they've really changed. I think he wants to know that. But this is his way to find out. The longest human speech in the book of Genesis is next. It's a little long. And Judah keeps referring to himself as your servant, or his father is your servant, my father. And, you know, so kind of some formal language. But this is an amazing speech. 44:18, Judah approached him and said, "Oh my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' We said to my Lord, 'We have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left with his mother, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him.' But we said to my Lord, 'The lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' You said to your servants, however, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again.' Thus it came about, when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my father. Our father said, 'Go back, buy us a little food.' But we said, 'We cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we'll go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, "Surely he's torn in pieces," and I have not seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, "If I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore, please, let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father?" Judah was willing to do anything so that his father didn't have to suffer again. Favoritism had been the reason to hate Joseph. It was now the reason to protect Benjamin. Judah felt so much for his father that he begged to sacrifice himself for a brother loved more than he was. I want to be the slave. Please let me take his place. Wow. Wow. Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him. When Joseph made himself known to his brothers, he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm Joseph! Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." They came closer, and he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." It has to be Joseph. Nobody else knew that. That's just overwhelming. But listen to Joseph. "Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine's been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant of the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he's made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt." Wow. A, Joseph totally forgives his brothers. And he tries to keep them from being upset with themselves or what they've done. Would you do that? But you know why he does that? That's the really big key here. He sees that God was behind what happened. The brothers had no business getting jealous of Joseph and selling him. That was absolutely wrong. But God used that. God can use Satan's tricks to glorify himself. And God used that to save the whole family from starvation. When Joseph saw what God was doing with that action, he wasn't upset with them. He was grateful to God for how this had worked out. Just so encouraging to see the attitude that Joseph had. And to think about how, you know, when we are wronged, when people really hurt us, if we only understood how God was using that to help us and to help us be better servants of His, it would be so easy to forgive. It would be so easy to accept because we would realize God's got it under control. He's working things out. His will be done. Amazing story. And may God help us to forgive injustices. And may God help us to see His hand and to trust Him. And may God help us when we go through 13 years of disaster for doing what's right, that we maintain our faith in God and we serve Him every bit as strong at the end of those 13 as at the beginning. One of the amazing things to me about the Bible is that every passage you read means way more than you ever know. And isn't that true with this one? I'm going to conclude with this. You'll understand this. Who am I? I'm the beloved son of my father. My father sent me far away on an errand of kindness. In carrying out my mission, my own people, because of jealousy, delivered me into the hands of strangers. I was sold for several pieces of silver. I was strongly tempted but resisted. Because of my righteousness, I was falsely accused and condemned. Two others were punished with me, though one of them was restored. God was with me and he reversed the hideous injustices. I came to have all authority second only to the supreme monarch himself. Even those who sold me ultimately bowed down before me. I became the means whereby God saved the very ones who had wronged me. After my death, I encountered first the 10, then the 11. Who am I? Isn't it amazing that in this whole story, that's just an awesome story, God was even revealing a whole other story? He was foreshadowing the story we know so well. And you see, only the wisdom of God could put design like that and a bunch more stuff that we've never even seen yet. If there's anything I want that to do, it's to just make us hungry to read the Word constantly and to mine it ever more deeply and to see what God's saying to us over and over and over again. If we ever get to where we think, oh, I know the Bible, we haven't been studying it. The more we read it, the more precious it becomes, the more we see, and the more awesome it is. Thank you for this week. If there's one who needs to obey the gospel, you've got one more chance in this occasion, and we encourage you to come when we stand.